Almost every day on this program, we report on acts of violence. Today, we want to tell a story about an effort to prevent violence in Boston. The effort started after a double murder. A man walked into a pair of clinics in December 1994. Eyewitnesses watched as he killed two people and wounded several others before his arrest.
And bang, bang, he hit about five shots, were gone. Maybe three and two. He hit both girls. He was maybe 3 yards away. He couldn't miss.
After the shootings, political and religious leaders appealed to people on both sides of the abortion debate to start talking, to calm passions. Three leaders from each side agreed. They began meeting with their bitter enemies and continued meeting secretly for 7 years. They never changed their minds about abortion, but they've grown to respect each other. Nearing the 30th anniversary of the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision, they sat down for one more conversation with NPR's Margo Adler.
We are meeting at the offices of the Public Conversations Project. It's a small white cottage in a suburb of Boston. Laura Chasen is a family therapist who has spent years facilitating conversations about divisive issues. Since 1990, she has helped lead many conversations on the issue of abortion. Today, I'm joined by four of the women who have been talking together for more than 7 years and whose conversations began as an attempt to ratchet down the rhetoric and violence that were in the air after two women were killed in 1994 in attacks on two health clinics. Before these conversations, Laura had facilitated discussions on abortion with individuals and some activists, but had never brought movement leaders together. Laura Chasen, remind us of the situation that prompted you to approach these women.
About 12 days after John Salvey entered the Brookline clinics and shot and killed and injured people, Cardinal Law and Governor Weld called for a lowering of voices and for what they call common ground talks. Among the people who were recommended as participants for this dialogue are the six women who eventually participated. And all they would agree to do, which is funny in retrospect, was meet for four meetings. So we met for four long meetings, and at the end of that time, they decided to keep going.
Now let's turn to our participants. Joining the discussion is Ann Fowler. She's an Episcopal minister, a past member of the board of directors of Planned Parenthood, and a board member of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. Also here is Frances Hogan. She's an attorney. She is president of Women Affirming Life, and she is a member of the Pontifical Academy for Life. Joining us also is Melissa Kogut. She is the executive director of Massachusetts NARAL, which is the state affiliate of NARAL Pro-Choice America. And we also have Madeline McComish, a chemist and past president of Massachusetts Citizens for Life, where she remains a board member. Welcome, all of you, and thank you for joining us here.
Oh, hello. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Let me start with Frances. Frances, as you approached the first meeting, why did you agree?
I agreed in response to the request of Cardinal Law and Governor Weld because I thought it might help actually tone down the rhetoric, and also because I had never had the opportunity to sit with people with whom I had such a profound disagreement and talk at a very deep level. We had always thought of people on the other side as kind of icons in the movement and had really never seen them as human beings on kind of a personal level, and this was an opportunity to do that, not without moments of tension and having tremendous anxiety before I entered into the meeting.
And what were your fears?
Well, they were at many different levels. One of the most serious to me was the fact that if people within the pro-life community knew that I was doing this, they might think that I was somehow or other sort of sitting with the enemy, so to speak, and that I was sort of a traitor to the pro-life movement. So that was a concern at a very deep level for me. That's not what I was doing, but, you know, perception is very important, really, in public policy type issues.
From what I've read at the beginning, there was a lot of discussion about language, over what to call each other, for example, over the words pro-choice, pro-life. Maybe I'll start with you, Melissa, but anybody else chime in? Talk about the decision to call each other the names you wanted to be called. How easy and how difficult was that?
It was very difficult in many ways. What we agreed to do in the course of the discussion was to call each other what we wanted to be called. And for so many years as a public spokesperson on the issue, I was very careful not to use the term pro-life because it implied that we weren't pro-life. So it was hard to make that step. But for the context of the discussion, in order to hear one another, I agreed to that. Over time, interestingly, even outside these discussions, I've become more comfortable to use the term pro-life, not just because they want to be called that, but also I found it descriptive of their position, that life is a preeminent value, and it came to be a common theme of our discussions.
I gather you also made lists of hot-button words, words that you thought would shut down communication. Let's talk about these for a minute. What would be some hot-button words for opponents of abortion, for example?
This is Melissa. The word fetus, which very much surprised me, is a scientific word that we use all the time, was something that was a tremendously hot-button issue for our friends on the other side. So we had to come up with another word, and the word we came up with was human fetus. It was a word we could all live with.
Yes, yeah. We had big lists.
Posted on the walls.
Posted on the wall, so to remind us that these words were off-limits. We had agreed to that.
It seems kind of crazy, I guess, all the focus on picking special words in order to communicate with one another, but it really served an important purpose to allow each other to hear what we had to say.
I gather that at the time of the trial of John Salvi, there was a point when several militant groups, in some cases, I guess at least one group that did advocate violence, was going to come to Massachusetts to support Salvi. And I believe that you, Madeline, asked him not to come.
Yes, it was appalling to me that he would even think of coming. He had made a statement in the newspapers saying that he felt that it was a valiant deed or a good deed or something that Salvi had done. And I wrote to him and I said, this is what you are saying is totally against everything the pro-life movement stands for. And at this time, which is very difficult for us now, you are not welcome in Massachusetts. And so he wrote back, and a few of his friends wrote back. But he didn't come.
Anne and Melissa, how did it feel to have that kind of support from a quarter you never expected?
I had never experienced this in any context at all. I mean, we've never had conversations with leaders of the pro-life movement in Massachusetts, and the fact that they would take this kind of action seemed courageous and compassionate, and it happened more than once.
You started out meeting four times, but you've kept this on for 7 years, or you did keep it on for 7 years. Why?
Well, this is Madeline. I'd say, first of all, because we came to develop a real affection for each other. Also because it was very intellectually stimulating. You were forced to really dig down very deep to say why you believed what you believed. I'd say those two things were maybe the most powerful reasons.
This is Anne here. We spent a lot of time over a number of years talking about when and how and if we could go public. And it seemed like an insurmountable problem for a long time, but I don't think any of us was willing to give up. We really felt we needed to somehow be able to take it out of the room. And we stuck together until we figured out the way to do it.
What do you mean, take what out of the room?
Well, we had been meeting at that point for 5 years and talking, and it had been secret, and we felt that we had accomplished a lot and that we wanted other people to know about our peacemaking. And the fact that we had been meeting, what we'd been talking about, and how it had worked.
And in 2001, you decided to go public. There was an article in the Boston Globe.
Well, you make that sound very simple.
how did you get to that point, and what were the arguments that,
Well, I think this is Anne talking. We felt that we wanted that the amount of time and effort and blood, sweat, and tears we had all put into this would not be economical if it didn't have a wider audience than the six of us and our two facilitators. So I think there was a sort of ethical imperative to do something with all this time that we had devoted to it. And people said, oh, you have a book here, you have a video, you have a this, you have a that. And we, none of us had the time to write a book. Particularly the pro-life women were concerned about giving up editorial control because of their experiences with the media. I think they can speak to this, but this may be a fair representation. And so what we came down to was we would jointly write an article. And although we had professional help with that, we still fought over nearly every word. And I would say of all the things we did in 7 years, getting that article to our agreement was among the most difficult things we ever did.
It took us 6 months at least to write that article because the agreement was that unless everybody agreed to every word, it would not go. So it took, you can understand that it was, there were a lot of words in that article. And so a lot of discussion took place.
This is Fran. At least I was never sure that I wanted it to go public. Still not sure I wanted it to go public.
And why?
Because I was concerned of a lack of understanding among a lot of people about what it was. In the beginning, the words common ground were used, and this was never about common ground. And we made that very, very clear. We never reached common ground. I was worried about a lack of understanding, misperceptions about what it was that we had done, in that, as the Public Conversation Project always said, we don't want to do any harm here. And so it took a lot of convincing, at least for me, to even agree to go public, by which I mean write this article and have it published in the Boston Globe.
What do you think, what did you achieve?
This is Anne. We spoke in the fall to the Ford Hall Forum, which is a local forum for ideas and often controversial subjects. And people in the audience were asking us what our product was. And we found ourselves a little tongue-tied about it. And afterwards, my husband said, you know, you have a product. It's hope. And we were talking earlier today about, did he have an idea of hope for what? And I said, no, I think it's a general stance. I think a position that can be applied to many things, an experience that can be applied to many things. And I would... certainly all the responses that I have gotten have had to do with gratitude and a sense of hopefulness that people can tackle a very difficult, divisive, painful issue and be civilized and even friendly in the discussions.
This is Fran. I could share a little anecdote, two little anecdotes. When the day of the Salvi shootings, I was on one of the local television news channels with Nikki Nichols Gamble. They had wanted another participant in the dialogue. And we had been called there to kind of, I guess as representatives of the pro-life and pro-choice positions, not that there was any pro-life position on the shootings that wasn't completely allied with the pro-choice position in that sense. However, before the show began, Nikki and I wound up in the same waiting room to go on television, and she was there with her husband, and I came in and sat down, and I never said a word to her. I never got up and gave her a hug. I never got up and said, I'm sorry about what has happened. I said nothing, because I was it was like we were in our assigned role, sort of. And I deeply regretted that as a human being. I felt that was a failure of my own. Later, after we began this dialogue, but while it was still secret, I ran into Nikki at a state house hearing. I think it was a Judiciary Committee hearing. And there were a lot of people from both sides in the audience that day. And she walked by me and she tugged my sleeve as if to say, you don't have to acknowledge that I'm here, but I'm just saying hi. So I turned around and did acknowledge her because I said, I'm not going to have that failing twice. And I felt that that was one way in which this dialogue impacted my personal life and kind of like my public policy life. And a couple of people come up to me and said, you know Nikki Nichols Gamble? And I was able to say, actually, she's a very lovely person. And it was shocking to some people, as it probably would have been to me before this all began. So, and I said, you know, we're never going to move the issue forward if we don't talk about it in a civilized way publicly.
Frances Hogan, Anne Fowler, Laura Chasen, Melissa Kogut, Madeline McComish, thank you so much for being with us on All Things Considered.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
NPR's Margo Adler. You can hear the full conversation and read the Boston Globe editorial on our website, npr.org.